Hi, this is Paul. This video that I did on the end of the Constantine Kitson, Sarah Hyder conversation did surprisingly well. But one of the things that stood out too were a few comments from some of you who are Muslim and complaints that I don't understand Islam, which I'll readily admit, and complaints that I'm not treating Islam fairly. I think there's a degree of presumption on your part that I somehow am what I'm trying to do is get a better understanding of Islam. Now, part of this has to do with what's happening with all sorts of religions these days, which is Islam the kind of thing that I learn about by reading something like Houston Smith's The World Religions? I've read that. I've read other books on Islam. I've read In the Shadow of the Sword. So I've got a fair number of ideas about some things, but that's not the same as having a broad amount of experience with Islamic men and women. And of course, Islamic men and women means very different things. I basically extrapolate about what I know about Christians, and just the diversity of Christians in North America, the diversity of Christians in the Americas, the diversity of Christians around the world, the diversity of Christians over time, these religious buckets are seas. They're filled with enormous amounts of things. Now, Sarah Hayder's points, of course, are, as are Ayaan Hirsi Ali's, come out of her own lived experience. Both of these are women who have pretty significant complaints about the treatment of women in places of the world where Islam is reigning and ruling. All I know about that is usually what I read and what I hear, and I take these women as being forthright and honest, but also they're telling their particular stories and have their own ideas, and that's fair enough. I remember speaking with a friend of mine who I knew in college, who went on to be a missionary in the Islamic world. And so I met up with him once at an event completely unrelated to anything. It was just, we had, it was a family member of his that I had some dealings with in church matters. And so we met up. And I got a chance to ask him about some of his thoughts in this. And he basically said, "I love the people, but I don't like the religion," which I thought was a very interesting statement. He felt, you know, he had met some of the kindest, most wonderful people he had ever known in this. I don't want to be too specific. It's a country in Africa, and it's not Iran or any place in the Middle East where you hear a number of things, but he just found the religion itself to be very cruel to the people, but found the way that the people welcomed him and treated him with hospitality just very, very lovely. And so I very much understand that kind of dimension. I noted this little piece on Twitter the other day, which I thought sort of brought in some of the tensions that I see in the issue. Hi there, Susan Sarandon. This is my mom, my dad, me on the rail trail at Morgantown, West by God, Virginia. Tell me what you think it means to be a Muslim in America. And so here's this woman and her father and her mother. First, your backstory. At an anti-Israel protest in New York City, you just said there are a lot of people that are afraid of being Jewish at this time and are getting a taste of what it feels like to be a Muslim in this country. Let me give you a taste of what it feels like to be a Muslim in America. My dad didn't have to become a second-class indentured servant to one of the many tyrants of Islamic countries that use immigrants from India. Like, my family was essentially slaves. In 1975, after getting his PhD at Rutgers, he was about to go to Libya, a Muslim country, led by a Muslim, Muammar Gaddafi, to work like a servant with a PhD for a wealthy dictator. But then the phone rang one day and I picked it up. It was West Virginia University calling, and my dad got a job as an assistant professor of nutrition. He got rejected first for tenure by being Muslim in America meant he got the right like everyone else got, his right to appeal. And guess what? He won, and he became a full-fledged professor. That's what it means to be a Muslim in America. You get your full rights, like Dr. Judy Jasser has wished for his family in the Muslim nation of Syria, where Muslim dictators destroyed the lives of the Muslims. My mom, being Muslim in America, meant she got to live free with the wind in her hair. What did it mean? So obviously she makes her point that there are many American Muslims living in America who are wonderful human beings, wonderful citizens, and I'm sure the practice of their religion leads them to be hospitable, kind, generous, moral, all of those kinds of things. Here in Sacramento, I don't have a lot of relationships with Muslims in the city, but my neighbor is Indian, and so he's Hindu. But he lived in Fiji for a while and got kicked out of Fiji because he was Indian and moved to Sacramento, spent a number of years being a baggage handler here at the Sacramento International Airport, retired a couple of years ago, has his children here, lives here. And so her point, of course, is that America is a wonderful land of opportunity. A show that I've spoken about briefly on the channel and watched all the way through was Rami, which I found to be a fascinating program because here's a young man trying to figure out what it means to be Muslim in America. And all the seasons were interesting and went into a whole variety of questions and issues about what it means, dealt with a lot of Jewish questions, dealt with questions of faith, dealt with questions of morality, just dealt with all sorts of very interesting questions. And again, what do I know? I'm watching a TV show to get my information, for Pete's sake. Of course, within Christianity, I know so much more. So for me, it's a learning experience, and I try to learn from at least the sources I have. Now, someone might say, well, you should develop a relationship with some Muslims in Sacramento, yada, 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 and that's true, and that might come, but that's also a fairly time-consuming experience. And you might say, well, you shouldn't talk about anything until you have that experience. But I also know well enough, having relationships with how many people from how many different backgrounds, how many different religions, how many different nationalities, that even if you do this with one particular group, there's going to be plenty of other particular groups that deny the validity of whatever group you're meeting with, and on and on and on. And I know that because it's the same with Christians. So, yeah. Doesn't mean I'm not going to continue to have thoughts and share my thoughts, because again, my channel is basically sharing my thoughts. I reserve the right to be wrong. I reserve the right to be told I'm wrong. I reserve the right to be called out. I reserve the right to be unsubscribed to, and reserve the right to be treated unfairly in the comment section. All of those things are all well and good and fine, but I'm just piecing this world together. Some of the big issues at play are, how do traditional religions treat women? Those are big issues, and those are huge conversations within Christianity. I just saw that. I should have Laura Smith on the channel. Laura was almost a classmate of mine in seminary. She teaches at Calvin University and is a brilliant, wonderful professor there. And I should probably just have her on the channel because she's terrific, and I've had many women on the channel. There's a vibrant conversation about how complementarian churches treat women, and there's sort of always this insinuation that complementarian churches, what I mean by that is churches that don't permit women to serve in ecclesiastical offices. There's often sort of an insinuation that such churches have higher rates of sexual abuse of women, yada, yada, yada. I find myself unconvinced by that, just for the fact that many people who are ostensibly pro-women and pro-feminist in all sorts of ways also don't treat women well. The way people sort of deal with their policy questions and the way that people actually deal with their personal lives is sort of really different. Just look at the Chris Williamson, Jordan Peterson conversation about how Ellen DeGeneres and other people are treating people who work for them. People often people of every sort have difficulty being personally consistent and personally sacrificial when it comes to treating other human beings. And so I continue to track the there's an entire YouTube thread about examining Doug Wilson in Moscow. And so you've got a woman who's a survivor of some really bad behavior by her father, on and on and on. And is this systemic? Part of what I see, however, is that Christians are, I think, hosting a rather vigorous, thoroughgoing, honest conversation about these issues. Now, many of you, some of you know and don't know on my channel that I am opposed to blocking women from church office. Leave your comments. Go ahead. Correct me in the comment section. That's absolutely okay. I've supported many women getting into the ministry in the Christian Reformed Church and will continue to do so. I think women should use their gifts. At the same time, I think a number of women like Louise Perry and Mary Harrington have put rather formidable arguments out there with respect to some of the ways that feminism, the Industrial Revolution, have negatively impacted women and led them astray. In the Free Press, there was an amazing conversation. Well, apparently the LA Times wasn't terribly impressed with it. I was quite impressed with it. Sarah Hyder was one of the mainliners there. Anna Grimes, and of course Louise Perry. I thought it was a wonderful conversation about it. And many have noted that you're not going to have a conversation like this in Saudi Arabia or Iran, or Syria or Jordan or Egypt. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm happy to be wrong about this. So the issues are real. And so I think part of what the conversion of Ayaan Hirsi Ali to Christianity is going to provoke are more deeper conversations about the relationship of Islam, let's say, to the treatment of women. And I find those to be big, compelling questions. I always have way more ambition to treat videos than I actually have time to, but I found this entire, I just played a little bit in that one video, but I found the entire conversation enormously compelling. Some people in the comment section argued that she didn't have great points and we men are simply dazzled by her beauty. Well, okay, maybe. But I listened to most of it with the video off. And I think there were some weaknesses in her arguments. But it's very easy for me to understand that a girl who grew up in America would find certain forms of Islam encumbering on the freedom that she wanted. I regularly hear similar things from women who grow up in Christian communities. Someone sent me this video from Reason, which had a little clip from Anna and Ayla, who again was the son of, or the daughter. She's the daughter of a, you're finding a vigorous conversation in our culture about these issues. And I think that's helpful.
The question of like how feminism plays into the sexual revolution and the degree to which are we living in a patriarchy? Are we living in a matriarchy perhaps? You know, are women miserable? If so, like why are they so miserable? Anna Kachian had some really interesting insights on that. Can we roll that?
So all of us here on stage are the winners of the sexual revolution. And the sexual revolution is the winner of the culture war. We finally found a way to have it all, and yet we're still not happy. Realistically, men really only had a few decades of enjoying the fruits of the pill before Title IX and Me Too made male sexuality presumptively illegal. And yet, here we are still having the same debate from the same assumptions. Women are objectified and oppressed, though it's no longer clear by whom. The patriarchy is alive and well, though apparently there's also a crisis of masculinity. No offense, but the idea that we live in a society where men are in charge is funnier than anything Tim Dillon has ever said. both men and women are invested in maintaining the fiction that women are the fairer sex, not operating out of ordinary incentives, just like everybody else. If you disagree, you're either autistic or an incel or both, which means you're right wing and you're not entitled to an opinion. The problem we now face is that this unofficial style has been officially baked into the system. The most problematic legacy of feminism is that it made topping from the bottom the top-down procedural thing. So my beef with the sexual revolution has less to do with its incoherent attitudes towards sex than with the way the resulting chaos has been leveraged to capture the institutions, the university, the media, and so on. What this means in practice is getting rid of the sexy 60s counterculture stuff while keeping the sexless school marm HR department stuff.
I mean, this is the view that I think most closely aligns with.
If you don't go to subscribe to Free Press and watch the video, that was just one of the most incredible sort of little snippets, and it was like, wow, who is that woman? That's an amazing little piece of writing.
How I look at things. I really appreciate her bringing the Title IX and Me Too era into this and basically saying, if we're living in such a patriarchy, why is it that there is so much, so much HRification of our institutions that end up in many cases depriving men of due process and acting frequently with this assumption that they have erred, that they have done something wrong, when in reality, the facts don't necessarily support that. How did you react to Anna's clip?
I mean, she's like, I'm quite sympathetic to a lot of it. Again, this might be like the part of the opposition that I like agreed with the most. It's like I said, like feminism happened and like men don't have a place anymore. And this sucks. To be clear, I think it's worth it. I grew up in a culture where we didn't really have feminism. And if it was worse than the way men have it today, quite clearly, but that doesn't mean men don't have it bad today. And I think like, we're just like a bunch of primates kind of reacting to what came before in unnuanced and uncompassionate ways. And I think like as a culture, we're sort of doing a thing where like, man, women had it shitty for a long time. Now men should have it shitty. What are men good for anyway? Which is another big part I feel like I don't hear talked about. It's like men used to have the function of dying in wars and fighting bears. And there's no more wars and no more bears to fight. But like women are still giving birth to children and having to do childcare. That's like an ancient burden that hasn't gone away. And so we're like, why men? Like, I think we sort of culturally figured that like the balance of inherent gendered obligations is now no longer, like men aren't paying their fair share in some way, which of course is not their fault. But I think this is partly some of the reason why we're seeing this general backlash. So we just need artificial wombs so then we can make it even.
What I hear in that clip.
So transhumanism?
Is that there's a, that, you know, Anna thinks, and I think there's a lot to what she's saying, that the discourse is sort of stuck in a past reality that does not exist anymore, and like, that
in some ways it doesn't exist.
What's that? In some ways it doesn't exist.
Well, but I mean, like, there's pockets. Like, I grew up in this world. Like, there's echoes of like treating women like shit that still happen. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think in most like Western media, liberal, big city culture, that like where these people are coming from, they're not very exposed to like women being treated like shit. But across the world, in conservative cultures, like women don't have rights. And in like conservative cultures in the America, still women like are treated like secondhand citizens.
Give viewers, I mean, Zach and I know a little bit about this from an earlier interview 2 years ago that we did with you. But give viewers a little bit of a sense of the background that you come from.
Yeah, just conservative, fundamentalist, evangelical, homeschooled Christianity in Idaho. Yeah. Like, you know, pastor type dad, and a stay-at-home housewife mom, where I was expected to grow up and become a housewife. I remember asking my parents, like, why do you think I should go to college if I'm supposed to be a housewife? And they answered, well, you can go to college to get a little bit of education so that you can homeschool your children and of course meet a husband there. And so I'm like, oh, that's my life.
And of course that didn't happen. So Aya's story is one story. her story is one story.
For having me here, guys.
It's great to have you. It's a pleasure to speak with you. I mentioned to you before that one of the reasons we so wanted to talk to you is you wrote a piece after the Salman Rushdie attempted murder that was so powerful and articulated things that I'd never really heard said in that way, which we're going to talk about. Before we get into that, though, tell our audience who may not be familiar with who you are, who are you? What's been your journey through life? How do you find yourself sitting here talking to us?
Well, I was born in Pakistan, but I was raised primarily in the United States. My parents came to America when I was about 8 years old. So that process of becoming an immigrant and acclimating to a new country, learning language, all of that, like that's a big part of my personal history, my whole self narrative. I was raised in a Muslim family. And so that was at first a sense of self-identity in this new place. It gave me kind of a grounding of who I was in this new place. And then over time, as I started to think about it, religion started to make less and less sense. And so when I was about, 15 years old, I left the faith. I left Islam. And it caused...
And of course, if you've listened to any of the Rando's conversations, this is not an unusual story. I mean, this is sort of you hit teenage years. And I don't know that it's so much developmental, but environmental that what happened... Well, it's both developmental and environmental, because at 15, you're differentiating from your parents. And then you tend to be integrating into this, the world's most powerful influence machine, which is American Hollywood media culture. And it just sucks people into it.
Many problems in my family, in my personal life. And for many years, I felt very alone with this and very burdened by this. I knew many people who had left religion, who were atheists from Christian backgrounds, many Jews who were actually, they were practicing, they would call themselves practicing Jews, but not actually believe in a God, which I thought was really interesting. But I had never known anyone like me. And for those who might not be aware, and I'm sure that many of the people in your audience do know, but there's a very extreme apostasy stigma in Islam, and really just a huge...
And of course, there's apostasy stigma within Christianity. It seldom gets lethal, however, especially in the post-Reformation Western world.
Stigma against dissent, religious dissent in general. It's not really something it's not exactly a tolerant religion when it comes to freedom of speech, freedom of thought, the freedom to leave a faith. So this was, it was a very isolating experience for me to leave the faith. And then one day when I was, after I had, graduated college and everything, I found another ex-Muslim. He was very fascinated with the idea of maybe starting something. And so we started an organization called Ex-Muslims of North America that exists to advocate for the rights of ex-Muslims, for the right to life in some parts of the world where apostasy is a crime punishable by death, but also just the social stigma and ostracism and sometimes pretty severe abuse that ex-Muslims go through. So it's really just an organization founded on secular principles, but also just to normalize religious dissent. That's sort of what we're orienting ourselves around and specifically focusing on Islam and the problems within the Muslim community. So that's how I spent a long time. And in my role as a co-founder of this new organization, an activist organization, I started to give talks and panels about the problems that I saw in the faith, mostly within an audience that was very friendly to me, other atheists, humanists, seculars, free thinkers, that sort of thing. And yet, even in that audience, I felt as if I was saying something nobody wanted to really hear.
Really?
Yeah, which is to say that they were on my page when it came to religion is bad. But when I started to talk about specifically what's going on with Islam, or why in some cases Islam might be worse, there might be specific challenges to this faith, then there was a, a sense of, wait, let's think about whether this is the right time to talk about these issues. Muslims are going through, you know, bigotry and you know, they're not accepted in the West. We need to think about whether this is the right, you know, time and place to be talking about these things. Or
and, you know, in the West is pretty broad, too. I would imagine that in America, the nuance is going to be different in different places and different countries in the West.
In such a way. So I felt a very powerful pressure, even within a community that I should have been perfectly welcomed in, to not really target my criticism so directly against the religious faith itself, to really start focus on extremists who are extreme, and they should be more like moderate Muslims who are peaceful and happy, and to the sort of what I called frou-frou language, you know, happy liberal language, that focuses on everybody. Most people are very good and kind and wonderful, and there's some extremists who are just messing it all up, and that's true. But we need to talk about what ideology really means. Because you can be a very good person, and if you have an ideology that tells you this is the good thing to do, you will do that thing. Mm-hmm. And so we need to just be thinking about what religions and ideologies are telling people are good and right things to do. Because then these good and compassionate and lovely people start to do some things that are probably not so great. Mm. So I felt unwelcome within this community, and very unwelcome actually in the broader progressive space. Mm-hmm. And that was very shocking and alarming to me. I think a lot of the people who end up in the heterodox space, one way or another, have this awakening, like this moment of like, wait, this is not how it's supposed to be. You're supposed to be agreeing with me. You're supposed to be on my side. I'm bringing up issues that you care about, equality between men and women, you know, no persecution of religious minorities. You agree with all this stuff, science, reason, all this that you agree with. You should be on my side. And then to find that you are actually not very welcome, and in fact, seen as suspicious, as someone who is going to bring in some toxic attitudes, and it was heartbreaking, you know, at first.
Really?
When because I was a good little progressive liberal, and these were values that meant a lot to me, and they were a big part of why I left religion, and you know, how I saw myself as a person, and to see myself being rejected, even though, in principle, I shouldn't have been. It was like being, you know, kicked out again because I left my community of origin, my religious community, and then again to feel that way on this political you know, tribe that I felt very close to.
I have
so these issues are very real for me. I mean, and they're massive. I mean, within the Christian community, within the Christian Reformed Church, even though the Christian Reformed Church settled on a political compromise with respect to women serving in office, that continues to be a stress in the Christian Reformed Church over this issue, felt by people on both sides. Moderates sort of feel okay about it. People on both sides sort of feel uneasy. But this is a massive issue of that pretty much everyone has to deal with. So it's not just Islam. It's also exactly the how do the sexes find their way? And you know, you're not going to turn the clock back to, I mean, people always point to the 1950s, where you probably should be looking at the 1550s instead, or even the pre-agricultural revolution. All of these revolutions brought on major shifts in terms of how men and women relate to one another, and how families and family systems are best pursued, all within contexts where nobody has perfect choices or completely open menus with respect to these issues. So I just wanted to say that word about Islam and women, and I intend to continue to, I mean, there's a menu of how many different ideas that I'm always sort of juggling in my in my head at one point. But this video really sort of grabbed me and made me think, because you could, on one hand, if you're sort of a new traditionalist, it's like, oh, we should go back to this. This has been a topic on the channel in the membership sections. There are my conversations with Laura that are in the membership section, because she didn't really quite want them on the open internet. But those were terrific conversations about, okay, she moved back to a traditional Catholic community. And what were the tensions there? Because all of those traditional communities and traditional roles were also part of the economic, social, educational environment. And you can't just reconstitute a gender situation or a sex role in isolation from the rest of the environment. So again, I continue to be, in that sense, someone who believes in open conversation and men and women having real conversations, searching, looking for the right way. And even within a religious context, where obviously you have a tradition, you have authoritative texts that you're working through, and those then have to be applied in different places. And again, this has been a fierce conversation within Christianity, only recently eclipsed by the same-sex marriage conversation. But these are important topics, and because they are important and because they deal in my life, I'm going to get into them. And you know, I'm going to apologize right from the outset that I may very well not get Islam right according to your ideas, but that doesn't surprise me, because I don't even get Christianity right according to the ideas of many of the people who watch this channel faithfully. And not getting it right and yet having opinions and having a space to talk about differences is, in many ways, the joy of this channel and the joy of this corner. And we've not had a lot of participation from Islam. I'm not going to sort of go out and seek it, but when it comes, I'll certainly be glad for it. And when it comes, we'll see how it goes. I mean, we have some participation from some Jewish quarters, but they tend to vary too in terms of how they see many of these things. So, yeah, it's a big topic, and I just kind of want to make this one little video to say, yeah, it's a big deal. It's a big deal. And if I do talk about Islam, I hope I do so at least as fair as I can. And again, if I get things wrong, feel free to correct me in the comment section. And I'm sure at some point there'll be more conversations, and off we'll go. But again, part of the reality is also that certain Islamic groups tend to be very reactive and very touchy and very polemic. And that's certainly on YouTube. We've seen that in a variety of ways. And some of you have been participating in those debates far more than I have, even some people in the corner. And for a long time, I've thought this will probably come at some point, and we'll see when and where it comes. And, you know, part of my pause with even opening the door in these kind of conversations are, yeah, I don't know how much of the door I want to open to it. But again, watching that show Rami about Muslims in North Jersey, you know, really opened my eyes to how, yeah, these questions are difficult across and with different religions. So leave a comment.